everyone. Bonjour. I'm Antonia Maioni, director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. Je vous accueille tous ici si nombreux. We filled up a room again. It's unbelievable. I'm really happy, Michael, that you've come out for this Fulbright lecture by Michael Dorscher. I'm so pleased. This is our last big event of the season, as they say, of the academic year, and I'm doubly pleased that Michael Dorscher, our Canada-US Fulbright fellow, will be presenting it. And it looks like it's going to be quite the ride, as they say, Michael, as we go through it. The Canada-US Fulbright lecture is part of a series of distinguished lectures here at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, including the Seagram Lecture, the Mallory Lecture, and the Eakin Memorial Lecture. The nice part about the Fulbright lecture is that we get to keep the Fulbright Fellow for the year, which is not like the other ones, which are really people coming in to give lectures. The Canada-US Fulbright lecture is really the lecture given by the fellow who's been in residence at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada for the academic year or the academic semester. The Fulbright Visiting Research Chair Awards here at McGill are part of a larger partnership between the Canada-US Fulbright Foundation and the university, and we were thrilled here at McGill that we've been the recipients of several Fulbright chairs since this program was set up. Let me just mention the two previous Fulbright chairs at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, Dr. W. Bartley Hildreth from Wichita State University and Stephen Farnsworth from the University of Mary Washington. And both of them are still within our McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's family, Michael, so it's never a long goodbye. You're always actually part of the larger family. So just so you know, in case you're thinking of just heading off home, that's not the way it works. You'll be with us forever. I'd like to now introduce the Dean of Arts, Professor Chris Manfredi, Christopher Manfredi, who will say a few words about what we hope is a foundation of further research initiatives on Canada-US relations. Thank you.
Thanks, Antonia. I'm still trying to figure out how come you don't need reading glasses yet. So I do. This is terrible. Well, thank you all very much. Welcome. Thank you, Antonia. Welcome to everyone on behalf of the Faculty of Arts at McGill University. Very pleased as Dean to once again lend our support to the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. Good, I didn't push a button. Everyone sort of, I did hit something?
No?
Okay, good. very pleased to be able to lend the support of the Faculty of Arts at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, which I've been associated with almost since its beginnings. I was one of the first residents at the old house on Peel Street until administrative tasks gradually moved me further and further away, but I'm never that far away from the activities. I'm very pleased that MISC and McGill has been involved in the Fulbright lecture series. Developing a program in Canada-US relations is one of the long-term strategic goals of the faculty, to house that in the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. It's something that we want to work on. It's one of the world's most important, it is the world's most important bilateral relationship, I would argue, certainly in terms of trade, in terms of security, in terms of a number of different issues that are at the forefront of our of global events at the moment. So we're continuing to build this lecture series, having the Fulbright visitor is an important part of that, and I'm very pleased that we're able to support it. I don't know how this is exactly going to work, but I'm supposed to mention that Jim Shepherd, who's the executive director of GlobeandMail.com, is going to introduce our speaker today, Michael Dorscher. He's going to do it by video conference at 4:40. Joanne, you tell me where Joanne goes. She can tell me whether I'm doing the right things or not. But I'm going to turn it over to somebody else to handle the technical details. So again, welcome and thank you for being here.
Bienvenue. Merci beaucoup pour venir ici aujourd'hui. And if I go much further than that in French, even though I've been thoroughly enjoying my twice-weekly French McGill staff lessons at noon, including today, if I go much further than that, I'll be making a complete fool of myself, and I'm entirely capable of doing that in English. So we'll proceed in English. You may have been watching, if you were here a little bit earlier, to see, let me go back here, my train trip all across Canada in both directions, starting in Winnipeg and coming east, going all the way to Vancouver Island, back all the way to Halifax, and then coming back through the northern tier of the United States. And I just am here to say that it is a beautiful country that you have here, and I'm very fortunate to have spent this time with you. I have a lot more to say, but to start, as promised, we'll let a former colleague of mine introduce me. A month ago, in the last distinguished lecture that Ian MacKay gave, even before he started his lecture, I was thoroughly intimidated because he had a wonderful introduction by Professor Desmond Morton. And I realized that at that moment, gee, I haven't worked with anyone here in Canada for years like Ian had. Who am I going to get to introduce me? And then I remembered, well, there is somebody who I have worked with in Canada, and he agreed to do a video introduction of me.
Hi, my name's Jim Shepherd.
In the constantly evolving and integrated world of journalism, I'm both the day editor of the Globe and Mail newspaper and the executive editor of globeandmail.com. And today it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Michael Dorscher, a longtime friend and longtime colleague of mine who's going to be speaking to you in just a few minutes. I first met Michael more than 10 years ago at the Washington Post, where we were building from scratch the site that's now WashingtonPost.com. In those days, there were no web publishing systems. We did it all by raw HTML. Every single one of the thousands and thousands of pages that went into the creation of the site had to be built from scratch in raw HTML. Michael was one of the supervisors of that process. He had a team of student interns who did some of the bulk work, but like me, he had to sit down and learn from scratch what a website was, what the Washington Post's website was, and how to build it so that it looked good when we launched. It took us about 6 months to do that, and from that time onwards, Mike worked for me as one of the senior editors of the site. He's one of the best journalists I've ever worked with, and I was sorry when he went into academia. I'm sure that he found greater fame and fortune there than he would have in the journalism business,
right. But
that's a different story. He was at our home in Toronto recently talking about the research that he's been doing into Walmart and its impact on local journalism in Canada and the United States, a fascinating topic that I frankly had never even thought about before he mentioned it to me. But it is reflective of the kinds of trends that are shaking journalism to its very foundations these days. First of all, in the rapidly evolving digital era, traditional television and newspaper companies are facing a very, very difficult future. They're struggling to adapt. We at the Globe and Mail have chosen to take an integrated approach to the journalism we do. We are in the final weeks of putting together a totally integrated management structure as well as a totally integrated news operation. I'm actually speaking to you from the Globe and Mail newsroom. This is being recorded by Anne-Marie Jackson. So she works for the Globe and Mail, a traditional newspaper company, doing video, which appears on the website. The kind of thing that a year, 2 years ago, was practically unheard of, but is now commonplace at major media, major newspapers across North America. It's a sign of how rapidly the world that we live in is changing. I think most of you know this already, but the expression young readers of newspapers or young viewers of network television is basically an oxymoron. They don't exist. They get their news, they get their information, they communicate with each other in very different ways from what we did even a few years ago, let alone when we were their age. All major media companies have to struggle to adapt to that new world. That's a very difficult thing to do at the best of times, and it's a horrifically difficult thing to do in the current economic circumstances that face both Canada and the United States. At the Globe, we've lost approximately 10% of our total staff in the last year due to a combination of buyouts and layoffs, which is making it more difficult for all of us who are still here to do the kind of high-quality journalism that's associated with our brand name. But at least we're still surviving and prospering to a certain degree. The same can't be said of a lot of local media outlets, and that's what Mike is going to be talking to you about shortly. You've probably seen or heard on the news how many local television channels and networks and stations are being closed down by their media parents. You've heard about the troubles that Can West is in, the entire chain of newspapers, and the global television network. But the local media situation is in probably more dire straits. Newspapers are going bankrupt in the United States, and as Dr. Dorsch is about to tell you, they're facing strong financial pressures within Canada, and Walmart, because of its policies, is at least inadvertently contributing to that decline. As media voices across North America disappear, the level of debate, the level of information that's getting out to the public is declining along with it. This is a trend that hopefully can be reversed, and hopefully can be reversed soon. And I hope that you enjoy listening to Dr. Dorsch's lecture. Thanks, and best wishes.
Thank you, Jim. It's all downhill from here. I get to take him to a Blue Jays game in a couple of weeks to pay him back for that at Sky Dome, or the Rogers Center, as they're calling it, for a few more weeks until they go broke, too. This talk, as Jim mentioned, I worked at WashingtonPost.com as one of the founding editors, and that capped a 20-year career in journalism for me. Much of what I've been doing over these past 7 months in studying Walmart and the media and putting together this presentation has been in anticipation of going back to my campus at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire in the fall and teaching my journalism students how to do multimedia journalism like this. And in the future, there's only one journalism class that I'll be teaching, and that is the future of journalism, whether it's an editing class, a reporting class, or a multimedia class. We have to find a new future for journalism. The Washington Post has set up a scholarship fund, a fellowship, in connection with my campus at the University of Wisconsin, because one of the alumni from my campus was the White House reporter for many years at the Post, Ann Devroy, and unfortunately, sadly, she died of cancer at a young age, 49. The Post set up a scholarship fund for her, and as part of that, every year, a reporter or editor from the Post comes out to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire to deliver a lecture. What we have found during these lectures, and Dan Balls, the White House reporter currently and political reporter, is coming in 2 weeks to UW-Eau Claire for that lecture. What we have found is that these print reporters, who are wonderfully smart and great communicators in writing, are not always the best communicators orally, and I would plead guilty to that charge too. And so what I'm going to do today is not lecture per se. I am going to show you what I have found in my journeys and in my research. I'm going to do this in a way similar to the way that Al Gore, the former vice president of the U.S., did in his movie, An Inconvenient Truth. And so for this day at least, I've actually changed. I have a new concise subtitle for my talk that relates to that. And along those lines. Before I get too far into this, I really want to pay my debt of gratitude to the Fulbright Foundation. This year has been a fantastic year, not only the best, but the most productive year in many ways of my academic career. And I have really enjoyed it, and I would wish that all of you, whether you are students or faculty members or professionals, would have this same opportunity. And you can. Since 1946, there have been more than 270,000 Fulbright Fellows of all different types. Over half of them have been from 155 other countries who go to the United States and study or lecture or research. And that includes students who have just graduated with their bachelor's, who are working on their master's, or who are working on their doctorate. and it also includes professionals in various fields. And then also the smallest part, and maybe the most visible, are the academics like myself. Also bringing greetings from my boss, and I was very happy to say that I supported Hillary Clinton in the primaries, the Democratic primaries, and so it was exciting for her to become the head of the State Department, of which the Fulbright Foundation is a piece. And of course, greetings from the president. The one thing perhaps that I can say with more authority than what Barack Obama has said it is that I love this country. And when he said that, when he was here in February, made his first trip abroad as president here to Canada, I was in my Montreal apartment watching the proceedings. Phone rang. It was my wife, who's back in the Twin Cities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, where she's an editor at a bankrupt newspaper. And, I said, oh, hello, I suppose you're just calling to confirm that both of your favorite Americans are here in Canada now. Without hesitation, she said, yeah, Barack Obama and who? moi? at any rate, I have a lot that I want to show you, so I'm going to go through this fast. There'll be time. I'm going to make sure there's some time for questions at the end. And, I don't know if I'll be able to answer them all, but buckle up. This train is leaving the station. Walmart, the largest company in the world, 4,100 Walmarts worldwide, 31 in the United States alone. And I want to show you something. Some of you may have seen before. In fact, I know at least one of you has seen who brought this to my attention. If you watch the year over here and the store count, you'll see the nuclear proliferation of Walmart. Unfortunately, this is just in the United States. Coming up, 1994 is the year Walmart first came to Canada. And this will actually stop at 2006 with nearly 500, more than 500 stores that are not even on this map. I don't have the same kind of interactive map exactly for Canada, but I was able to find this. There are a lot of Walmarts in Canada too. You can see they're mostly clustered in the south, where most of our population is, but there are Walmarts in the north too. Now, I hope I have to turn this on. On this side, perhaps. Maybe not. Work on that later. But you can see across the north, too. And most of the Walmarts in Canada are in small cities, which has also been the case in the past, early on, in the United States. The reason the focus for small cities for Walmart originally, it was not a business decision especially. It was because Helen Walton, the wife of Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, utterly refused to live in any city that, with greater than 10,000 population. And so that's where they started, and then they found out that this was a great place to do business. So let me give you just some key dates and background about Walmart Canada. This isn't a comprehensive history by any means. It started in 1994 when en masse they purchased 122 Woolco stores. They already had many stores in the U.S. Jumping ahead, things, you know, fairly smoothly until 2005. Most of you have probably heard about the Jonquière Quebec store and the unionization of that store in March of 2005, followed by the closing of that store in October of 2005 when they got their first contract shortly after that. Forward to this year, there are now 316 Walmart stores. There will be 320 by the end of this year. 82 of those are supercenters. There are no supercenters in Quebec because of their concern about the greater unionization in Quebec. Walmart is now, they'll see how that plays out. Walmart is the fourth largest employer with 80,000 employees, soon to pass, maybe already has passed, as this car parts company, Magna International, shrinks in size. It's probably the third largest by now. George Weston, of course, the Loblaws holding company, and Onyx is a stock holding company, financial services, and many of those 237,000 employees for Onyx are in the United States, actually. And they're not listed on, Walmart's not listed on this list from the Globe and Mail because they're not based. Their headquarters, per se, is not in Canada, but it is that great size that allows Walmart to continue to expand unabated in Canada. And it is the largest company overall that is in Canada. Back in January, I went and covered the Supreme Court appeal of the union representing the Jonquière employees. You see one of the employees here in the Supreme Court, outside the chambers in the hallway, and wrote this story for the paper in Little Rock, Arkansas, which is kind of the hometown paper for Walmart. And I'll just draw your attention as I talk to one quote from the story here from the arguments in the Supreme Court. And we'll see whether this is an argument that holds sway with the Supreme Court justices or not. Both of the main attorneys for the argument were from Montreal here. It was very interesting to me as they seamlessly switched back and forth between French and English in their arguments. And we had simultaneous translation headphones, those of us who needed them. And then I'll talk a little bit more later about Walmart's effort to become more environmental, more of a green company and a leader. And this store in Burlington, Ontario, is the first of many supercenters they say that they'll be building that are much more energy efficient and less wasteful. Walmart is one of only two companies that are in the Dow Industrial Average, the 30 companies in the Dow that did not lose money last year, and the other company being one that is often co-located with Walmart, which is McDonald's. McDonald's stock rose 5.6%, not even a third of what Walmart's gain was. And if Walmart's 18% gain were not included as the largest company inside the Dow Jones Average, that loss for the Dow Jones would have been more like 40% last year. The worse the economy gets in some respects, the better it is for Walmart. People feel like they need to save money and spend as little as possible on their necessities. They believe that Walmart is the best place for them to do that. So let me go back a little bit. There's an ironic piece of history that not many people are aware of. In fact, when I was talking to the two lead corporate spokesmen for Walmart Canada, they weren't aware of this. The fact that Sam Walton, he bought his first store in 1945 using the money that he had made in newspapers. He started his newspaper career the same way I did, as a newspaper delivery boy. And he not only had a big newspaper route himself, when he was in college at the University of Missouri delivering the Columbia Missourian, Sam Walton was already an entrepreneur. He was the manager for all of these newspaper deliverers, and he earned enough money from his newspaper delivery business, plus a little bit that he saved from a short stint in the Army and a loan from his father-in-law to open up his first dime store himself in 1945, Ben Franklin store. He parlayed that into the first Walton's Five and Dime store in Bentonville, Arkansas. The Ben Franklin was in Newport, Arkansas. Again, both of these towns, less than 10,000 people at the time. It was on Main Street in Bentonville, the Walton's Five and Dime was. But that was 1950. In 1962, he opens up the first Walmart store in Rogers, Arkansas. And here's a picture of its grand opening. And at that time, he again relied on newspapers to give him the advertising, or for him to buy the advertising to make that first store an immediate success. So newspapers were integral to the birth of Walmart. Step back. How did I become involved in this? A little, as I say here, French-Canadian town. You may not be able to, it's not entirely clear. The name of this town is Botno, settled by Pierre Botno, who actually was also one of the settlers, the founders of my hometown, which is Minneapolis, Minnesota. He was one of the founders. He was a French Métis, Canadian fur trader. And Botno, as it's sometimes called, B-O-T-N-O, I'm going to give you a quick little tour of Main Street, Botno. Oops, if I can get my cursor back. So there's the Botno Theater, one screen, the only screen in town. Some services. Main Street, and it's called Main Street, is about four blocks long. There's one dollar store, a card store, an optometrist, the jewelry store, and the hardware store. The hardware store was the first business in Botno, been in business for 115 years continuously. In Botno, there is a community college. I should back up and tell you that Botno, the population is 2,500 people in Botno. But they have this two-year college. They have their hockey rink. They're very proud of their hockey teams. They've won national championships. One of their alumnus is a Stanley Cup champ, brought the Stanley Cup to Botno a few years ago in the summer. He's now on the Edmonton Oilers, Dustin Penner. There's a Pomida store, is the discount store on the edge of town. It has about 30,000 square feet of retail space. And there's now, as of March 1st, 2008, a Walmart store in Botno. And to give you an idea of the size of the Walmart Supercenter compared to the Pomida store, this Walmart in Botno is 100,000 square feet, full line of groceries and just about everything else that any Walmart carries. And the Walmart in Botno is adjacent to where my father-in-law is. The cemetery, which was on the edge of town and is now lit up by the Walmart lights 24 hours a day. This Walmart is open 24/7, 365 days a year. The supermarket that was also on the highway where Walmart was, our name says it all, Super Value. It doesn't say it all. Super Value's closed within 3 months after Walmart opened. There's now one store in town other than Walmart where you can buy food, the Jack and Jill's. It's about 10,000 square feet compared to Walmart's 100,000. And it actually tried to close. It started a going out of business sale, and the Super Value beat it in closing sooner, and the people in the town prevailed upon it to stay open for now at least. The Pomida store is now rumored to be on the verge of closing. Their lease is up in 2010, and it is not likely to be renewed. And the one part that I should mention, also, of course, you probably foretold what the moral was. The hardware store, 115 years in operation, closed the first week that Walmart was open. Of course, it had been struggling, and that owner needed to sell in any case, but people in town say, well, this hardware store had been sold many times before and opened, and certainly it would have continued with somebody running it if it were not competing against Walmart. This town, if you haven't already guessed it, is not in Canada. This is Botno, North Dakota, and that's here on the map down in the corner. Across the top is the international border between Manitoba and North Dakota. This Lake Metegoshi up here at the top is where most of the doctors and lawyers in North Dakota have their summer lake homes. And so they can now come up Highway 5 here from Fargo or Minot, Grand Forks, Bismarck, come to the Walmart on the edge of town and get right on this highway past the golf course onto the Lake Road without ever going into downtown Botno itself. Further reference, this is the International Peace Garden. If any of you have ever been there, I highly recommend it if you haven't. And on this corner is City of Dunseith, which is part of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation, and where Walmart first wanted to build, and the Chippewa Nation refused them the right to do that, and because they're a sovereign nation, they could do that. And so Walmart did the next best thing, which built in this town of 2,500 people, Botno, and now most of its employees and on many days most of its customers are Native Americans from the Turtle Mountain Chippewa Reservation. When I was there in February, I talked with another good-looking bald guy, the editor, one of only two reporters, and really only one and a half reporters, at the weekly paper, the Botno Courant. The Botno Courant is the only business in Botno that is older than the hardware store. And I asked him what kind of effect the Walmart has had on the Botno Courant and what it's been like trying to get information from them.
If I initially go out there and like do a story, say at the very beginning when they opened up their business and they started construction, I'd go out there and try to get information. And they normally would just send me to their headquarters in Arkansas. They wouldn't answer, you know, questions per se. The manager themselves, they would just say, you know, here's a number, call, you know. and I would go and make calls, but the phone calls would never be returned. You just get voicemail, you know, and I'd leave a message and once or twice, sometimes three times, and they would never call me. Our revenue has gone down about 10 to 15% since Walmart's opened. A small town, and there's only so much revenue that can go around, with the opening and stores, probably because I don't know, because no one speaks about it to us, that for some businesses their revenue is probably down themselves, so they probably just don't have the money to do advertising as much as they have done in the past with us. So, and of course Walmart does no advertising with us, not any advertising from them. Hardware store is closed and a grocery store is closed. Is that due to Walmart? No one's ever said, but two major stores have closed since.
And both of those stores would have weekly flyers in the Botno Courant every Thursday usually. And as Scott said, the Walmart, since its grand opening, has never had any advertising except for when they've had small classified ads trying to hire more people. And that 15% cut in revenue is really significant. It's felt in the newsroom at the Botno Courant. But I'm here in Canada. I don't want to spend all of our time in the United States. And so I went to another town that has a Walmart and that is experiencing similar things. Owen Sound, you can see up here in the corner, is on the southern edge of the Georgian Bay, Lake Huron. For reference, you can see Toronto down here. And let me just take you on a quick little tour of Owen Sound, almost 10 times the size of Botno. As I said, it is right on the Sound. It's a port. It's a beautiful town. River runs through it, the Owen River, from the south, the north into the Sound. Its main street looks like this. You see some services, bookstores, credit union, a little tobacco shop, no department stores, no major retailers. Downtown still has the City Hall. And also downtown, an issue at the City Hall is this A&P supermarket, which is owned by Metro here, and it is downtown close enough for people to actually walk and carry their groceries home from. There's also on the edge of town quite a few big boxes. The Zellers, there's a Zayers food market too already, food discounter, the Sears, Canadian Tire, and next to the Canadian Tire and next to the Home Depot is the Walmart. The Walmart in Owen Sound is about 60, 65,000 square feet. So here's a town that's 10 times larger than Botno and has a Walmart that's only a little more than half as large. But they at the Owen Sound Walmart have applied to the city council to expand the store by 35,000 square feet to bring it up to the size of a supercenter in the United States. And that 35,000 square foot expansion would be all about carrying more groceries. So they would have as much grocery space as the A&P market that's downtown already has. And that market is struggling. And let me show you quickly what they do already sell some groceries at the Walmart in Owen Sound. And it's similar if you've been to a Walmart in the Montreal area, in the suburbs, a pantry, basically a shelf. So, they have a lot of boxed goods, some bread that's brought in. There's no bakery there. Again, dairy products that are shipped in, not from any local dairies. the Dairy Case, and kind of these giant, big old, always lighted cases, and just a few of them. Nothing fresh, in other words. Now, just to show you quickly a side trip to Brockville, Ontario, which is down here in the on the right side. You can see it located in between Toronto and Ottawa. Owen Sound would be up here just off the map. In Brockville, they have a nice new Walmart Supercenter with a large grocery section, a 35,000 square foot grocery section that is like the one that they want to build in Owen Sound. And I'll take you inside of it. A lot more grocery aisles, fresh produce shipped in, most of it from Central America. You can see as far as you can see food, deli, bakery, and just take a little walk with me down the length of this meat counter, this meat freezer, which is huge. You can see they're trumpeting their Canadian meats. None of them, however, are wrapped fresh there in Brockville. They're all butchered in a central location where they can have non-union butchers. It goes on and on compared to what they now have. They don't have any of this. And you can see the line, how many freezer cases they have. And these freezers are energy saving. Only when you approach do the lights turn on. Part of their green initiative. So, when I was there, I went to Owen Sound when the city council took up Walmart's application to approve this expansion. They needed approval from the Owen Sound City Council because Owen Sound has a city plan that says our downtown area is preeminent, that needs to be protected, and anything that would damage the livelihood of the downtown area is not something that we will support. And so Walmart is saying that the A&P store downtown will not be affected by its expansion into groceries, or B, that it would be going out of business anyway and there's nothing that can be done to help it. On this night, though, Walmart, at the last minute, came forward and asked for an extension to its request so that it could further review the data that A&P had put forward as to the health of its business. I don't know if every city council in Canada starts this way, but they do in Owen Sound.
As Walmart pointed out in their letter, the only person impacted by this, by Walmart's request for a deferral,
the extension.
Walmart's request for the zoning change and the official plan amendment, I think it's fair to say that we would expect Walmart to appeal. Certainly there are cases, development issues that I've read about in other areas north of Toronto, in development areas where after being taken to the OMB by opponents of a development and having the development upheld, that the developers have then gone after their the people who appealed for a portion of their costs. And, you know, stories that I read, they're talking about millions of dollars.
Argue exactly what you say, that there will be tax revenue for this from this expansion and that there will be employment. And then the other side of the argument is that it flies in the face.
They refer to as her worship. She wears this yoke.
Some would argue exactly what you say.
You're probably more aware of the record of Walmart than I am, but I think they've got a pretty strong track record of winning most of their battles. Just because they have a track record, that wouldn't be enough to deter any of us to change a vote. You don't vote on whether somebody has a good lawyer and is likely to defeat you at an OMB hearing. You vote in terms of the issue itself, and is it right for the community, is it right for the residents of the community, and that's why you vote and you deal with the rest later. A good lawyer and is likely to defeat you at an OMB hearing. You vote in terms of the issue itself, and is it right for the community? Is it right for the residents of the community? And that's why you vote and you deal with the rest later.
The OMB that the mayor and Councillor Twaddle were referring to is the Ontario Municipal Board. I don't think they have anything quite like this in Quebec. They do in Alberta. But this is by far the largest one of these boards. And as I say here, it is a place where they hear appeals across the province to development issues. And these 26 appointed members divide up to 2,000 cases per year, so they're each hearing about 80 cases per year. Walmart has had over 100 cases before the OMB that have been decided, and that includes 24 last year alone, so it's accelerating, six so far in the first few months of this year, and they haven't yet gotten the Owen Sound decision. There's another city council meeting in Owen Sound on April 20th scheduled, and I hope to go back for that to see further what happens with their application. But as Councilman Twaddle said, it can, it doesn't have to, but it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and to appeal one of these decisions before the OMB. Several cities have spent that much in Ontario in Walmart cases because, of course, for Walmart, Walmart has a full fleet of attorneys on retainer. In Owen Sound, then, not to forget about the media, I talked with a reporter there, similar to Scott Wager in Botno, and when I arranged an interview with Danny Langlois, called ahead, and when I got there, he said, you know what, this is a really busy day for me, and the only way that he could spend time, his editor told him, talking with me, is to also interview me and do a story, one of his three stories that he has to do every day on me. And that was the result of that. Got a nice picture out of it. I talked to Denny about what it was like dealing with Walmart Canada and what effect he's seen in Owen Sound.
When I first started, there would have been seven reporters that would have done general news work, and now there's three. So the stories on your beat aren't necessarily as in-depth as they once were. So there's less research that can go into a lot of stories. There's a lot more relying on sources as opposed to research. I would have liked to have done more reaction pieces to shoppers at the Walmart. Those would have been good stories to do, to talk to people as they were leaving. Why do you shop at Walmart for your groceries? There is a grocery section now, albeit a lot smaller. And also shoppers at the AMP, why would you shop here? Would you leave the AMP to go to Walmart? What are your thoughts on Walmart expanding? So sort of the more people stories would have been good to do. Also doing more of an analysis and getting reaction to the market impact study that was provided that's now being challenged by AMP. It would have been good to really delve into that data and to try to see the accuracy of it and see what other people in the community thought of it. I've been trying since these stories began to try to get someone at Walmart's head office in Mississauga, and so far haven't been able to despite repeated phone calls and emails. People definitely talk about the fact that concern about the dollars going to the States as opposed to staying here. The biggest concern that people seem to be bringing is about Walmart's employment history and their ethics. And so that has dominated a lot, and we've found that we've had to sort of narrow down the public discussion on it to say, this is about the expansion, this isn't about Walmart coming to town, it's about them wanting to expand. Questions for people definitely talk about the fact that concern about the dollar going to the state as opposed to the state. The biggest concern that people seem to be bringing is about Walmart's employment history. Sort of narrow down the public discussion on it to say, this is about the expansion, this isn't about Walmart coming to town, it's about them wanting to expand.
Okay. From Owen Sound, about 200 kilometers southeast to Mississauga, the home office for Walmart Canada, because I'm a Fulbright scholar, not just the gumshoe reporter anymore, they talked to me, and I had an interview that went 90 minutes. It was supposed to be only a 30-minute interview. I'll show you about 3 minutes of it, with the top two spokespeople for Walmart Canada. And I asked them about their dealing with the media.
In the front page of
I think we're one of the most open companies in the country. I'm told that all the time. The
proposal of a store expansion in Owen Sound to us is not a PR exercise. It's a planning exercise. And it's an exercise where the store has good and sound reasoning for expanding the store. They've got good and sound information that we've put forward to the city. The city has subsequently, city staff has subsequently said to city council, this is a supportable decision, and city council now has to make its decision. And I personally don't think that discussion is best made in the pages of the paper.
In the country, I'm told that all the time. I think we're one of the most open companies in the country. I'm told that all the time.
Proposal of a store expansion in Owen Sound to us is not a PR exercise. It's a planning exercise. And it's an exercise where the store has good and sound reasoning for expanding the store. They've got good and sound information that we've put forward to the city. The city has subsequently, city staff has subsequently said to city council, this is a supportable decision, and city council now has to make its decision. And I personally don't think that discussion is best made in the pages of the paper.
I think we're one of the most open cases in the country. I'm told that all the time. The
proposal of a store expansion in Owen Sound to us is not a PR exercise. It's a planning exercise. And it's an exercise where the store has good and sound reasoning for expanding the store. They've got good and sound information that we've put forward to the city. The city has subsequently, city staff has subsequently said to city council, this is a supportable decision. And city council now has to make its decision. And I personally don't think that
usually
discussion is best made in the pages of the paper.
Yeah, I think we're one of the most open companies in the country. I'm told that all the time.
Proposal of a store.
And briefly, I asked them about their advertising policies, why there isn't more advertising revenue from Walmart Canada.
We're not a big advertiser compared to... When it comes to environmental sustainability, suddenly that size becomes a huge advantage because through our wide-ranging, far-reaching global waste reduction, energy reduction, sustainable product initiatives, packaging reduction, we've become a pioneer in a relatively short time in driving huge change in the business world on environmental sustainability. And it's changed a lot of people's perceptions about us. I think there's some people in the intelligentsia, people who can afford to shop elsewhere, who didn't particularly like what they thought we represented. They're now looking at us as a leader in this area. Environmental sustainability, we were very clear when we started this journey 4 years ago that it's not a public relations campaign, it's not a marketing campaign. We were afraid to talk about it because we were afraid that we were going to be criticized for doing it just for optics. Because we're not a big advertiser.
I'm going to go on. And the last issue that I talked with them about is their initiatives to be more environmental friendly, more green, and what connection.
When it comes to environmental sustainability, suddenly that size becomes a huge advantage in our profile. And because through our wide-ranging, far-reaching global waste reduction, energy reduction, sustainable product initiatives, packaging reduction. We've become a pioneer in a relatively short time in driving huge change in the business world on environmental sustainability. And it's changed a lot of people's perceptions about us. I think there's some people in the intelligentsia, people who can afford to shop elsewhere, who didn't particularly like what they thought we represented. They're now looking at us as a leader in this area. Environmental sustainability, we were very clear when we started this journey 4 years ago that it's not a public relations campaign, it's not a marketing campaign. We were afraid to talk about it because we were afraid that we were going to be criticized for doing it just for optics. We were very clear that it's not because we were afraid that we were going to be criticized for optics.
So remember that the next time you hear a press release about their green efforts or see an ad about it. Moving toward a conclusion now, a little bit more stepping away from journalism and a more academic look at this issue. I wanted to see what differences there were between coverage of Walmart in Canada and the U.S. And as just a quick and dirty exercise in this, I randomly selected a month's worth of newspaper issues from the last year, from 2008. 30 days spread throughout the year, looked at every daily newspaper story in Canada and every daily newspaper story in the U.S. during those 30 days about Walmart and compared just whether they were positive, negative, or neutral in the tone of their coverage from Walmart's perspective. And what I found, there is no difference. That Walmart Canada has been just as successful or unsuccessful, depending on your viewpoint, in its dealings with the media. And also, out of this total of 729 stories, the 102 stories from Canada last year in this sample, not one of them was an investigative story. The 627 stories from the United States on Walmart last year, during those 30 days, not one of them was an investigative story or even an interpretive story. Those have been done somewhat in the past in the United States and in a few places like McLean's in Canada, but they're past that. That no longer is something they're dealing with. These P figures, by the way, probabilities for lay people, if those were under 0.05 or less, that would indicate that there was a significant difference between the coverage in the two countries. While I was traveling by train across Canada, I read 25 books. I've read over 30 books about Walmart. I think every book that's ever been written about Walmart, and the best one of those, of all of them, was written by a Canadian, Tom Slee, who you see here. And Tom Slee's argument in the book, No One Makes You Shop at Walmart, is this, in a nutshell. Walmart has great prices. Some people might think that its prices are, like this shows, three times better than other stores in a town that doesn't have a Walmart. But what Slee says is that it's not just prices that affect people in a town where there's a Walmart. And I'm going to show you his argument by filling in the data. So, okay, Walmart might have three times better prices. What about selection? When the Walmart comes to town, before Walmart, say in Botno, there's a hardware store, there's a supermarket, there's a Pomida. They're not there once Walmart comes to town. There's less selection, even though the Walmart store is much larger. People like to have storefronts and amenities in their downtown, in their main streets, not just boarded up for sale windows. The city falls, traffic problems grow. The jobs are better paying when they are locally owned people and the money stays in the town instead of, as Denny Langua says, goes off to Arkansas for the profits. And as we've seen, the media have more advertising revenue and sources who are more willing to talk to them if they are not dealing with Walmart. And so that's how Tom Slee says that you lose with a Walmart that has prices even three times better than the other stores in your town before the Walmart, because there are so many different areas where Walmart has a detrimental effect. Oops, sorry. I don't think I'll play all of these for time's sakes, but there are a couple of short clips. I wasn't able to get to Waterloo to interview Tom Slee on camera. I talked to him on the phone and recorded.
I would say Walmart is very good at helping us save money, and it's terrible at helping us live better. Simply pursuing the low price goal is not going to deliver us a healthy society or healthy cities.
And Tom says that Canadians and Americans...
In many ways, I think Canada is far more similar to the U.S. than perhaps we like to believe. But in this particular case, when it comes to our retail habits, we're really very similar. With one or two exceptions, and perhaps more, you know, around Quebec, there are perhaps more exceptions. But in general, the Canadian consumer is very much like the American consumer.
You might be able to tell, well, Tom Slee has lived here in Canada for 20 years. His PhD is from here, but he is... from England originally and also has postgraduate work at Oxford.
The development industry has been very effective in capturing the Ontario Municipal Board. It only makes sense for them to put a lot of resources into making sure that that board is friendly and to make sure, let's say, that that board understands the development industry's point of view. For the rest of us who are citizens who are, for whom the Ontario Municipal Board is a rather remote thing, it's very much more difficult for us collectively to get together and have influence.
And I'm going to skip this one, which is pretty self-explanatory.
But when that company gets huge, as Walmart does, then it begins to reshape the whole landscape, and then it becomes a problem. So the issue with Walmart is one of scale. And I think the issue with Canadian media is also one of scale. We used to get three papers. We used to get the local daily paper. We used to get a national paper. And we used to get a weekly local paper. And then we looked and we thought, these are all owned by the same outfit. There are simply not many different voices in Canadian media today.
Okay. A little more theory to try to wrap this up. Antonio Gramsci was an Italian Marxist in the 1920s and 1930s. I'm sure Professor McKay is familiar with him, and Ian here. A nutshell definition of what hegemony is, the key things are that it's this: it keeps going around, coming around, using power by using the culture, and it's crucial that you have a negotiation process. It's much more powerful and longer lasting if it's not an overt, explicit use of muscle power, either in terms of weapons or money. The key, though, is that the people who are negotiating always have the upper hand. The hegemon always has the upper hand in these negotiations. And what this leads to, oftentimes, most times, are the people who resent this forming a counterculture group, a counter-hegemony. And I'll show you how this might work, too, a little bit later. And then just to round this off, pluralism is, in contrast to hegemony and counter-hegemony, a sharing of power, and it is the opposite. Counter-hegemony is not the opposite of hegemony. Counter-hegemony is just somebody else's hegemony that has not yet risen to dominance. How does this work for Walmart? Starting at the top there, And I'll just remind us of a few things that, we've heard in order to, get an idea. I can find my place in my notes here. So, power. Walmart has the power of size, of economies of scale, which allows it to negotiate with suppliers in a way that it always has the upper hand. It has built its empire debt-free since Sam Walton opened the first Walmart in 1962. He has been debt-free and built on their profits. Culture, the second box from the top here, going clockwise. Walmart is the leading seller in the world of CDs, of DVDs, of video games, of magazines, of clothes at a price level that most people can afford, and of some kinds of books and electronics. And in the United States, they are the leading seller of food, and that is why all of their new stores in Canada are super centers that include food aisles. This creates an ideology where Walmart represents low prices equals high sales equals a reliable profit in good times and bad times, and therefore market dominance. Common sense making is in the 5 o'clock position here. Common sense, Walmart tells you they always have the low prices on everything. Of course, it's not true. They only have the low prices on those things they feature in their in caps and their aisles, but they don't really tell you that if you compare. They tell you there's no need to shop everywhere. It's all under one roof. It just makes sense to go there. And toward the city councils, common sense is that resistance is futile. They'll go to the OMB. They have the attorneys. They'll always win. Status quo keeping at the bottom. You know, in Owen Sound, for instance, they've convinced some members of the city council staff, and at the newspaper, editorial board at least, that this is just a business expansion. It's nothing new. It's just free market capitalism. They're already there. What's the big deal? We've already been helping your community for years. The status quo is that our prices are always being rolled back, and we're always upgrading our product lines and fashions. Of course, each new year's products cost more. Co-opting. Like I said, they have convinced the city council in Owen Sound. In Vancouver, the city council turned down Walmart's applications twice, and Walmart then simply bought a Costco store that was moving to a larger location, and Walmart moved into that Costco store without needing any approval from the city council and expanded it, and it is a huge hit inside Vancouver. And then moving on to the left side of the equation, the negotiations, talking about we're going to be the leaders in environmentalism, that in the U.S. you'll be able to shop online. You can get all sorts of kosher products, East Indian, Mexican foods. We're catering to each clientele. And then if people are not convinced, the line normally goes from negotiation back into the power cycle. Power is consolidated and built up. Those who are not convinced, they're marginalized. Those are the reporters whose calls don't get returned by Walmart, or their emails. They don't let them on their property. They don't advertise with publications that the intelligentsia read. They don't do business with suppliers who balk at cutting their costs, even if they have to ship their jobs overseas in order to match those costs. Finishing up, taking it back to the media, this is just a chart that shows how concentrated in four companies, really, Canada's media are, and it's impossible to keep up with what's going on, all the daily headlines that have literally here been ripped from the paper to show the bad news, including the one today in the middle that the Can West has gotten an extension for 2 weeks before it is most likely forced into bankruptcy with the Montreal Gazette and its television stations. Last video clip, I talked here 2 weeks ago during the policy conference with Christopher Waddell, who's here, and asked him about the media landscape and how he explains it.
Since the 1970s, it's been a very increasingly concentrated industry in the hands of fewer and fewer people. In 1988 or 1989, here the government allowed the same organizations to own newspapers and television stations in the same markets, which they hadn't allowed before. So they allowed a degree of concentration that hadn't existed before. But it's always been a fairly concentrated industry. I think we have we certainly have more concentrated ownership in Canada than we have in the United States. Along with that consolidation, a gradual cutting of resources, cutting of people, cutting of specialization, cutting the number of people in newsrooms, and which was accentuated when the world of convergence came along. The people who owned media organizations believed that the same people could work for a variety of different media. I mean, the analogy I would give you is someone, I've hired someone for 3 days to paint my living room and dining room and kitchen at home. It only takes them 2.5 days, so I've asked them to do maybe a couple of landscapes. In maintaining large profit margins, they've been cutting and cutting and reducing the quality of the product, I would argue, in good times and bad, because there's never the management consultant view that says you can do more with less is a short-term view. You can do more with less for a short period of time, and then you start to do with less. But if your business model is to acquire as much as you can by debt and accumulate as much debt as you can doing that, and then presumably on the assumption that there will never be a recession or never be a slowdown, and you require a 20% rate of return in order to ensure you can make your interest payments on your debt, and you require something that
at some point that comes up to get you. In Canada, we spent a long time, probably quite rightly, worrying about the impact of media concentration of ownership on editorial product and editorial content in terms of diversity of voices.
The product that the media sells is the ability of the people who work in the media to take complicated and difficult things and explain them in a fashion that people will understand. This news organization says you have fewer and fewer people in the newsroom, fewer and people doing the oversight and doing the, wait just a minute, let me think about this for a second. You lose some of that context. But your audience doesn't necessarily lose that context. And you risk finding that your audience thinks you're just not very smart. And in the internet world, they can go somewhere else to find the information.
Dan? It's news organization. Your audience doesn't necessarily use that context. And you risk finding that your audience thinks you're just not very smart. And in the internet world, they can go somewhere else to find the information.
Last slide. So an attempt to explain what has happened with the media here. At the top, counter-hegemony, the marginalized groups who no longer feel like the media meet their needs, the established media have found new ways to share information. Social culture full of blogs and Craigslist and Facebook and blogs about the media, starting with the Drudge Report, which beat the Washington Post on the Monica Lewinsky scandal story. Continue the way the media are going with so much debt, as Christopher Waddell said, it's just a matter of time before a new media company becomes the owner of these established old media company and finds the ways to make news a social network that will be interesting and important to those people who are now in the counter hegemony, and it will ascend to its predominance. So thank you very much for your patience and attention.
I think we've about 10 minutes of time for questions. I just wanted to say thank you. I'm not an Italian Marxist, but I do live in a household where my husband won't let me shop at Walmart. So it's interesting to hear this this talk by Professor Dorscher. We have 10 minutes for questions. Our two rules that we have at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada are as follows. We prefer that a student asks the first question. That's okay with you, Professor Dorscher. And second, Luke is there with the roving mic. You're not allowed to touch the mic. Okay.
I should know better. I was wondering if you could expand a bit. Something you touched on, and I think it's even more significant than you really got into, is the fact that Walmart does not advertise. Now, you said that what we've got here is the largest company that's grown over the last 20 years. We've also seen a decline in media during that period of advertising revenue. We tend to blame Craigslist. I'm wondering if you might have anything that looks to this relationship between advertising revenue in the media and the rise of Walmart.
Getting data, hard data on this has been impossible. I've looked and I've tried, and Walmart certainly is not helpful about it. They would not tell me their advertising budgets or anything like that. But the point is that maybe I didn't make clear enough is that it's a couple of layers to this. It's not just that Walmart doesn't advertise much. It's that they don't advertise with local media, as Jim Shepherd said at the start. That really hurts media in cities that are under 50,000, under 25,000 people. And secondly, the businesses that are competing with Walmart, in order to match Walmart's prices, they oftentimes feel they have to cut their advertising budget. Or thirdly, those businesses fail in their competition with Walmart. They go out of business, and many times those were faithful advertisers and local business people who use that revenue in their area.
Do you know anything about the salaries that the associates are paid? In comparison to base salaries or whatever one might call them.
Yeah. Walmart Canada says that its average salary is close to $10 per hour for its associates. And that's probably about a dollar per hour higher, they say, than in the United States. Part of that is because of the threat, the greater threat of unionization in Canadian Walmarts. And also, we didn't talk about it, but prices are generally higher in almost every case in Canadian Walmarts than they are in U.S. Walmarts, which is why there are Walmart, one of the reasons there are Walmart stores in Botno and many other border towns in Maine and Vermont. To draw in Canadian shoppers who are close to the border. And the reason the prices are higher in Canada is that they're paying the higher taxes to pay for health care, which they are not doing for more than about 60% of their employees in the United States qualify for health insurance, but not all of them. Many of them cannot afford the premiums.
You said basically that Walmart has such a big influence or control over the OMB. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the process that Walmart employs in getting that control over the OMB.
Well, a lot of the process is very hegemonic in that, and is exemplified by what's happening in Owen Sound. they will file appeal and delay after delay motion in order to draw out these cases when they feel that they are not yet in a position to win the case. And it's oftentimes a war of attrition for them to triumph over the city councils or the private citizens who are appealing Walmart decisions.
Hi, Mike. You spoke briefly about, or you showed the bar graph of the content analysis that mm-hmm. you did with the positive, negative, and neutral, comparing Canada and U.S. I was just wondering if you had a sense of, other than the tone, what kind of things were written about. So greenwash was mentioned. Is that an example of something that would be a positive? Like, is the media picking up on that as something positive? Or can you just give us a sense of what the stories were actually about?
A little bit, yes. I mean, yeah, I read them until my eyes were falling out. But the positive stories oftentimes are about their environmental efforts. Other times, many of the positive stories are about their lower prices and about their stock rising. About them opening new stores, grand opening stores. The negative stories most times are about externalities such as competing stores closing, or really oftentimes maybe the single largest one is the amount of crime that gravitates toward Walmart stores, both in Canada and the United States. Crime in their parking lots, which are not patrolled, which they will not put video cameras in, security cameras in, because they don't want to be held liable. Crime inside the stores because of the type of clientele that they attract.
Given the tension between Walmart and organized labor, I wonder if you have any data on the extent to which union-controlled pension plans hold Walmart stock and invest in it. And if they do, what does that say? And if they don't, are they negating their fiduciary responsibility towards the people for whom whose resources they're investing?
That's a great question. It would be very interesting to do that study. I don't have the data, but what I know, based on the way Walmart stock is incorporated in the Dow Jones Average and the Standard & Poor's 500 in the United States, is that any entity, any company, any union that has an index fund is going to have more Walmart stock than any other single company because it is the largest. And so only those that have socially conscious stock portfolios will not have Walmart stock.
Is there another way for these big box stores to do business? You mentioned Costco, for example. Is that a different model than Walmart?
It is in some ways. And the people at Walmart say that's why Costco and Target in the United States, if some of you are familiar with that, have been hurt much more by this current recession, and their stock prices have dipped into the red because they are not still able to compete at the very lowest price margins that Walmart is. By providing more benefits, by providing a greater selection, by providing more local goods, and Target, for instance, has a lot of local food that it uses in its super Targets. Those all cost more than what Walmart brings in imports.
Sam Walton, while he was alive, he received the highest civilian honor from George Bush the first, as opposed to WMD Bush, which is the second there. Getting back to the stock, in his day, people were given stock and minimum wage in the States, and some of them became millionaires by keeping their stock a very long time. But lately, the Walmart stock has been pretty flat. It's been paying a lot of dividends, but is it the same stock arrangement they have with their employees, minimum wage employees, than Sam had when he was alive, or is it moderated?
No, I think I've asked about this a little bit. I think it's better than ever, their stock benefits potentially. However, as you say, they haven't had the splits, they haven't had the astronomical growth that they had earlier, and more than that, there have been fewer and fewer employees, both by their volition and Walmart's preference, who have had long-term, 2-3 decade careers at Walmart and have kept that stock till it could mature.
Michael, one more question. Oh, Professor Velk, you've got to take this question.
Right. Isn't it possible that Walmart is successful because it pleases its customers, because it provides them with a wide variety of goods? Don't they really advertise because they have a website? If the firms that fail once Walmart comes along no longer satisfy their customers, isn't that what should happen to firms that don't satisfy their customers, that they should fail? Can't you buy things that Walmart doesn't have if you don't want Walmart, if you're in a small town, by going to Amazon, by going to eBay?
And Walmart is having more and more partnerships with online retailers such as Netflix, and they've had some partnerships with Amazon too. They're getting those revenues. Tom Slee, the author from Waterloo, would say, you know, yes, all of that is true if you only want someplace to shop that has the lowest prices and you don't care about any of the other externalities. Many people do care about those things, and a lot of people refuse to shop in Walmart, and then they not only are not getting the benefit of those externalities, the greater selection, the, you know, nicer town, the better employment picture, they're not only getting that any longer, they're not getting low prices that Walmart has to offer either.
We're going to keep on going.
All right. Thank you.
In the Onsound case, you said that the staff report was very much on the side of Walmart. Is that generally the case, that the staff reports tend to be in favor of Walmart and the politicians against?
The staff for the city council, yeah. Not the staff for the newspaper.
Yeah.
Is that generally the case? I think that is generally the case, because the politicians are more accountable to their voters, the people who they hear from all the time, and the people don't go and complain to the staff. And secondly, the staff are more accessible to Walmart than they are to the to the voters. And so Tom Slee and others would argue that the staff are much easier to capture by Walmart than those who are accountable. But city councils across the continent, including Mexico, have capitulated to Walmart in the vast majority of cases, but not every case by far.
Okay.
One more, Max?
Yeah.
There is refreshments outside, people. You're not going to get to them if you keep...
In the spirit of co-opting opposition, if you were given the chance to be a guest CEO for 4 months of Walmart, what kind of shifts would you want to take the company in? Or is this kind of imaginary hypothetical just part of kind of a hegemonic logic that should not be posed?
Well, certainly one of the most hypothetical questions I've ever been posed toward me, and no one offered me that when I was at Walmart Canada headquarters. No, I couldn't believe it. I was pretty much ready to do it. But I think my goal would be to try to make Walmart be a company where you actually save money and live better.
With that in mind, I'd like to thank you very much, Michael. You know, in this room, there's a lot of Canada-U.S. going on. Professor Velk is actually from Wisconsin, and Professor Manfredi's mom is from Owen Sound, so there's more convergence than you think in the room. I just want to say that I think the Fulbright Foundation should make a note to send every Fulbright scholar who comes to Canada on that train ride across Canada, and I'm sure that you've inspired many students in the room to do the same. And with that in mind, I'd like to ask one of our Canadian Studies students, Siobhan, to thank you formally.
On behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I would like to thank you for presenting this year's Fulbright Lecture by presenting you with a small token of our appreciation. And we wish you much luck in your future research. Thank you.
And off we go for refreshments. Thanks.